case for argument this morning is Fairley against Andrews. Mr. Pierce.
May it please the court. Plaintiffs, two former guards from the Cook County Jail, complained that they were subjected to intense harassment by the defendants in an effort to prevent them from testifying about the use of excessive force in a civil rights lawsuit brought by jail inmates. Plaintiffs had repeatedly spoken out in opposition to many such instances of excessive force over the years, incidents that they had witnessed. And they had done so in spite of what they have testified was a de facto policy and practice of concealment of such abuse at the jail.
Mr. Pierce, let me see if I understand properly what one of your theories is here. And I'm stepping beyond the jurisdictional question that your opponents have raised. As I understand your position, you think that the district court should have conducted a factual inquiry to see what the quote-unquote real requirements for the job as guards were, and that, in your view, the district court then would have discovered that far from a reporting requirement, one of the real requirements was the code of silence, and thus by reporting, the guards were actually stepping outside the scope of their official duties?
With regard to our retaliation claim, Judge Wood, that is correct. We believe that the inquiry under Garcetti as to the actual job duties is a factual inquiry, although related to the Connick-Pickering inquiry, which pertains to the subject matter of the speech, we submit to the court and believe that the court has dealt with it this way in Davis versus Cook County, among other cases. It is a factual inquiry because the actual duties, which the Supreme Court has clearly said may not be the duties that appear on paper.
Sure, no, they say that in Garcetti, I understand. But are you familiar with any case where the paper duties, clearly, we all recognize that on paper the guards are supposed to report this kind of misconduct, where there's such a flat contradiction between what you say the real duties are and what the paper duties are?
No circuit case. There are district cases that have so held, but I would call to the court's attention that even accepting, setting aside for a moment the so-called code of silence, the de facto policy, even accepting those general orders as being the boundaries of the job duties of the plaintiff, much of the speech in this case had nothing to do with the reporting mandated in those general orders. And because the court simply ruled that everything job-related at the workplace, everything having to do with excessive force at the workplace, all such speech was pursuant to duties, court never conducted a factual inquiry, either disregarding our argument with regard to the code of silence or accepting it.
Okay, and so I just to finish up this thought, I mean, as I understand what you're trying to do right now, you're trying to go forward on a theory that the real duty was to keep silent, and thus you have a retaliation claim, and as I see it separately, you're trying to go forward on a theory that your clients were intimidated from their participation in testimony like in the Fields litigation. Are those two separate points?
Those are two separate points, as is the point that I just tried to make, if not as articulately as I could have, and that is, with or without consideration of the de facto policy of concealment, there is a question of fact whether arguments with fellow guards, which is some of the speech that's at issue in this case, at closing time, at the gate while you're leaving, you shouldn't have beaten up that inmate today, whether those statements are statements made pursuant to duties, even accepting the language of the general orders which mandate that a correctional officer should report to the divisional superintendent and to IAD illegal conduct, and of course, use of excessive force would be illegal conduct. So it's really more nuanced than that, but yes, we do believe that the Garcetti inquiry, for a variety of reasons, needs to be made with regard to the retaliation claim. With regard to the intimidation claim, we don't think it's relevant.
So is there any connection between the two claims?
There is connection between the two claims, Judge Posner, because they both arise out of illegal harassment which took place. The question is, what's the motivation?
The speech involved in the two claims, is that the same? Or
the speech involved,
overlapping or what?
The speech involved is the same, but in the case of the retaliation claim, of course, it must be First Amendment protected. In the case of the intimidation claim, it may provide evidence, and indeed we think does, of the motivation to engage in the intimidation. We knew these guys spoke out all the time.
Now I'm lost. Yes. We're both lost.
Well, let me try again then, because I certainly don't want that to happen.
You have two claims, one you call retaliation, one you call harassment.
Yes.
And my question is, are they based on the same speech?
No.
Okay, so what's the difference?
The retaliation claim is based on prior speech. The intimidation claim is based on a desire to prevent speech, which is not yet.
No, but this is, you know, the speech, it's not past, the same. Yeah.
It's not past versus future, but what kind. I had understood you to be saying that there was speech within the chain of command, that is, within the prison, and then speech that was planned within the judicial system. Is that right or wrong?
There are three kinds of speech, Judge Easterbrook. There is speech at
the
workplace.
Well, say yes or no.
The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Well, no. There is a third kind of speech. There are those two, and yet there is a third one as well. Speech at the workplace, which is not within the chain of command.
Now, the speech that was going to be made in court, a deposition, something like that, is that the same? Is it all about the same thing?
It is.
So the content is the same.
That's correct.
It's just different times or different places.
That is correct. The content is about the incidents of excessive force at the jail.
I have to say I'm now a bit confused because I thought that one of your points with respect to the intimidation claim was that there are many ways to intimidate somebody and you don't necessarily even have to have been speaking yet if the intimidation is designed to prevent you from speaking in the future, if it's in effect a prior restraint.
That is true.
Okay, so in that case, then speech within the jail doesn't have much to do with the intimidation claim. If it's really designed to cause people to shut up in the future.
It is not an element of the claim. It is evidence that is relevant to the claim because it is the reason why the defendants knew to suspect that our clients would testify honestly about the incidents if called to testify as they ultimately
were. Okay, so that's your evidence that somebody said actually something about this future.
Our clients spoke out repeatedly.
So is it your view that, so suppose there's, someone says something within the chain of command that would not be privileged under the First Amendment, is it the Garcetti case? If that person simply repeats the identical words in some other form, does Garcetti just fall away completely?
Depends on the form, Judge Posner, but Garcetti could.
Well, why does it depend on the form?
Garcetti itself said.
So suppose he says it in a newspaper editorial or in a deposition or what have you. Does it make any difference?
Yes, because under those circumstances, it is not pursuant to duties. Pursuant to duties.
Either one. So he says something to his superior that is not privileged, and he repeats the same words to a newspaper reporter, and then it is privileged. Is that your conception of
that? That is my perception, and indeed the Garcetti case so indicates that the self same speech in a different context.
What Garcetti said, as I understand it, is that if Sabalos had written in an op-ed piece the same thing he wrote in his internal report, he could still have been fired because he was speaking outside the chain of command. One obligation of his job was to report to his superiors rather than the newspapers. Now, I take it your position then has to be that giving testimony in court is not subject to that ground of discharge.
Absolutely true.
Okay.
We complain before this court of three erroneous rulings of the district court. First, the district court ruled that a claim for
it's not grounds for discharge because it's the court, because there's an interest in having people testify or what?
Because it violates no rule that I'm aware of the employer.
So if Cook County had a rule that said before any officer testifies in court, with respect to events that happen at his place of work, that testimony must be cleared through his supervisor, then we might have a situation that looked more like Garcetti.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're saying there is no such rule. I understand that, but I'm just saying hypothetically if there were.
It would be closer to Garcetti. Of course, in your hypothetical, I'm not sure where the violation of that rule would take place. But yes is the answer to your question. It would be closer to the Garcetti
situation.
You may know
the federal government has such a rule. This is not at all hypothetical.
I understand, and many governmental employers do have such a rule. The district court ruled that with regard to our claim for intimidation or ex ante restraint of future speech, there was a requirement that the harassing conduct seeking to censor that speech.
I have one other question about what you're arguing and what you are not. I should think that there would be state statutes dealing with whistleblowers and, for that matter, retaliation against people who testify. Are you relying on any of them?
We are not, and do not believe.
Why? Why does one start with the Constitution rather than with applicable statutes?
There is no applicable state statute to the conduct in this case, Judge Easterbrook, and the common law with regard to retaliation is limited in Illinois.
No applicable state statute. So if somebody testifies in an Illinois or federal proceeding, it's perfectly legal to shoot them dead on that account?
Oh, there may be a criminal violation under state law for witness tampering under those circumstances, but in terms of a civil cause of action, there's a wrongful death action.
Most states, and I'd be very surprised if Illinois were not among them, provide civil remedies for witness tampering as well.
I am unaware of any such statute in the state of Illinois.
You're unaware because you have looked and found none, or? And that's a big surprise.
The district court added to our intimidation claim an element that the harassment must be triggered not only by a desire to censor future speech, but also out of retaliatory motive with regard to prior speech. Secondly, the district court ruled that all of the many statements engaged by plaintiffs in opposition to excessive force were not First Amendment protected in light of Garcetti, even though there are material disputes that we have already talked about with regard to which of plaintiff's statements, if any, were required as part of their job duties. And thirdly, the district court granted summary judgment on plaintiff's conspiracy claim, even though it found that there was ample evidence from which a jury could find that the defendant's harassment of the plaintiffs was done pursuant to a de facto policy in place at the jail of concealing abusive inmates and punishing those who tried to reveal it.
I know you've made that argument several times, but I'm puzzled why you persist in it after Garcetti. Seems to me the more you say this was done pursuant to an official policy of the office, the more you put this within the domain of Garcetti. Right? It looked to me like this argument was conceived as one to deal with Monell and get official capacity liability. But your effort to cope with Monell has dug you a big Garcetti hole.
I'm afraid I don't follow, Judge Easterbrook.
I thought that might be the case.
That's why I was trying to, at the beginning, get at the question. Let's suppose, hypothetically, that Cook County, in its written policies for the jail, had, paragraph 15, no officer shall ever reveal anything that he sees in the way of abuse of inmates to any other person, period. There will be at this jail a code of silence. And now these people speak out, so they're not abiding by my hypothetical written requirement for a code of silence. It's your view, as I take it, that being retaliated against for speaking out against that hypothetical policy, up to and including being fired for it, would fall outside Garcetti?
Well, I think that it would raise a facial challenge with regard to the constitutionality of that particular hypothetical.
The reason I'm asking is I'm trying to get at, again, this idea that you seem to have that because these people violated the code of silence, they were retaliated against, and they were, in a sense, violating a policy. They weren't. They were going outside the scope of their duties, if it were, you know, if the scope of their duties was to keep their mouth shut forever, then talking was either a violation of the duties. I'm not sure that this theory holds together, but I'm actually really just now trying to understand it.
I do understand what you're saying. That is, under Garcetti, would violation of the code of silence be a violation of the policy of the employer?
Right.
And my answer is that Garcetti speaks to reasonable, justifiable rules of an employer.
And it goes back to what Judge Easterbrook was saying, too, because there are many instances in which violation of the rules of the employer is perfectly good cause for an employer to terminate someone, because that's, you know, that's what you do to keep the workplace functioning. So I'm not sure how we put this all together.
Right. What? Sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm puzzled by your statement that Garcetti applies only to good rules of the employer. Garcetti seems to say it applies to rules of the employer. What actually happened in Garcetti, firing somebody because he truthfully reported problems in a criminal prosecution, doesn't sound like a good rule. The Supreme Court didn't say in Garcetti that it's speech if the rule is bad, but it's not speech if the rule is good. I mean, that just makes Garcetti trivial. It makes it go away.
Understood. Understood.
So the problem, this is what I was getting at.
Yeah.
Garcetti has to apply both to good rules and bad rules. So suppose the employer has a bad rule, which is don't rat on your fellow guards. Right? It's a bad rule, but it's a rule of the employer, and it's part of your argument that this is the employer's rule. You're making that argument to avoid Monell, but as soon as you say this is the employer's rule, seems to me you've dug yourself a big Garcetti problem.
There is no longer a Monell claim in this case, Judge Easterbrook. We make it to show.
It may not be any longer, but
we make it to show that there was concerted action in support of a common goal, and that the finding of the evidence with regard to Monell, as there was a Monell claim, necessarily contradicts the conclusion.
What does concerted action add to your case?
It adds a conspiracy claim.
What is a conspiracy claim do?
That the defendants joined together.
No, what does it do for you?
What does it do
for
you?
Want it?
Other than sink you under Garcetti.
It broadens the evidence at trial, primarily. It doesn't
add any
element of damages.
Conspiracy claim has no effect whatever on admissible evidence. None.
Well, except that the statements of co-conspirators are admissible
against their conspiracy. Yeah. You can introduce the evidence, but you don't have to have a claim.
Right. The co-conspirator admission doctrine has nothing to do with whether anybody is making a conspiracy argument in the case. It's totally unrelated.
Very well.
If you'd like to save rebuttal time, it looks like you're
I would like
there.
To save rebuttal time. Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Roche.
May it please the Court, John Roche on behalf of the appellees. Plaintiffs who successfully voluntarily dismiss their claims have neither the reason nor the right to appeal such rulings. In this case, prior to the September 26th...
When did they voluntarily dismiss their claim? I looked for a notice of voluntary dismissal. You didn't point it. I couldn't find it in the record. So where did they voluntarily dismiss their claim?
Prior to the September 26th hearing, plaintiffs had requested that the court reconsider defendant's motion for summary judgment, which was previously denied. During that hearing, the district court judge said that their motion was more properly a motion to dismiss their claims rather than a response to a motion that was no longer pending. Plaintiffs, during that hearing, admitted that the court had accurately described the relief requested by the plaintiffs, that they were seeking dismissal of their claim.
Well, only in the following sense. And the district court's language, I think, makes this quite clear. They had presented arguments under Garcetti, under various other theories, to the court. The court had rejected their positions. The court, I think, had made it quite clear it was finished with that issue. It wasn't going to reconsider it anymore. And so they said, based on that set of rulings, we recognize we can't go any further. It's time to take it up to the Court of Appeals. And the judge said that. The judge said, I'll dismiss this case and we'll see what the Seventh Circuit said. There's words to that effect. And, of course, once you get a – you can't take an appeal until there's a final judgment. This looked to me like a fairly routine decision on somebody's part, that the time for reconsidering a very important predicate legal ruling was over. In light of that ruling, dismissal had to happen, but that ruling is certainly contested. I don't see any lack of adverse position on this appeal. So I'm not sure how you come up with this theory that just because at the end of the day they agree to a dismissal, that it's somehow the equivalent of saying, and also, Judge, we think you were right about everything you've said along the way. I didn't see that sentence anywhere.
Certainly, Your Honor, but the district court can't decide whether or not this court should
hear
the
appeal. Look, we've had many cases, although not recently, in which a person says to district court, okay, you know, I'm not getting anywhere with you. Maybe there are little pieces of the case left, but you've thrown out my major claim. I'm not interested in the other claims. So I'd like you to enter judgment and I'll appeal. It's mm-hmm. a perfectly sensible way of proceeding. There are many cases about it.
And of course, yes. One of them, which I will remind you of, is called Downey against State Farm. It's back in 2001. We considered what seems to me arguments identical to those you're making and held that there was appellate jurisdiction. Your brief doesn't discuss any of our cases on this subject.
Your Honor, I think we do cite some of the recent cases, Radar, Chavez, International Marketing, and something I'd like to point out. During the hearing on September 26, the district court told the plaintiff's counsel that it found that there were still viable claims that they could go to trial. The plaintiff at that point didn't like the rulings up till then and didn't like the nature of the case that was going to go to trial. So they said, we'd rather have this case dismissed. If the court recognizes this kind of principle, it is allowing plaintiffs who are unhappy with district court rulings to simply stop the proceedings.
The judge doesn't have to dismiss it, no.
Well, if a plaintiff won't proceed, the court would then have to involuntarily dismiss the case.
The plaintiffs took a dismissal with prejudice. I mean, they're rolling the dice. They're coming up here. If we happen to think that everything the district court has done thus far is correct, they're not going to go back and reopen anything. If we think some things weren't correct, then they may have the case that they're striving to present. It's really, I don't see anything either consensual about what the plaintiffs did or anything actually other than the fairly routine acts that my colleagues are talking about.
Isn't it in effect, though, an end around the
interlocutory appeal? Why? They've taken a dismissal with prejudice so that this critical ruling along the way now is embodied in, you know, or made part of the final judgment. If they can't now go back and have just a little piece of a trial that they might have had, but they're rolling the dice.
The other point I'd make is the in limine evidentiary ruling is not a final ruling. It's something that the court could have reconsidered during the trial or at any time. And because of that, if plaintiffs had gone forward and made persuasive arguments or introduced evidence that convinced the court that any of that information should have been allowed into evidence, it's something that could have been reconsidered. And under the invited error doctrine, which we discuss in our brief and is discussed at length in Thunderbird, where a plaintiff invites the error or a party invites the error that leads to the appeal, they are precluded from, during the appeal, raising that very same issue. In this case, in the Seventh Circuit, we cite a number
That's
of cases.
It's not a jurisdictional matter, is it?
I think it's a practical application by this court as to whether or not a party has a right to appeal something that it's asked for.
I don't comprehend that. Jurisdiction follows from a timely notice of appeal following a final decision in the district court. That's all that's needed for appellate jurisdiction. One can forfeit a right to jurisdiction by agreeing to that order. If you file a voluntary notice of dismissal, you can't appeal. Whether you can review a particular ruling of the district court has nothing to do with jurisdiction.
Well, then couldn't a plaintiff, at any time they were unhappy with rulings, simply voluntarily or agree to a dismissal of their case to take that issue up on appeal? Exactly what this court found was not allowed in Rader.
Just as Judge Wood said, if you want to roll the dice, if you want to say, if I lose on this issue, I'm cooked, and appeal, and you lose on that issue, you're cooked. But that just shows it was a final decision. Case is over.
Let me change the subject. I don't understand your discussion in your brief of the harassment or intimidation or whatever you want to call it, the second issue. I mean, suppose I said to you, if you leave this courtroom and ever criticize this court, I will cut your tongue out. Now, wouldn't that violate the First Amendment?
Your Honor, I think in the retaliation context...
Look, just answer my question.
Forget retaliation.
Don't embroider it.
There would certainly be a...
Well, let's fuss. Look, say yes or no. Then you can explain, instead of hedging and fussing.
Your Honor, I think there would be causes of action.
I said yes or say yes or no. Can't you say yes or no?
No.
Apparently not. Okay. It's not in your vocabulary. Maybe that's a lawyer's trait. Words yes or no do not constitute a part of you. Okay, answer it any way you want.
Your Honor, I think there would be cause of action, whether there would be a claim.
Can we translate that as a yes?
Under the First Amendment.
Well, what other amendment should it be? I don't understand. Why wouldn't it be a First Amendment claim?
Well, I think there would be state law claims that I
no,
could
No, why have. Wouldn't it be a First Amendment claim? Why don't you answer my question?
Are you acting under
don't
color of law?
Don't ask me a question. Why would it not be a First Amendment claim,
If you're not acting under color of law...
Would you answer my question? What do you think I'm acting under? I'm a judge. I say if you criticize me, I will cut out your tongue. Now, why isn't that a First Amendment claim, right? I'm certainly acting... I'm acting under federal law. I don't like to be criticized, right? So...
I guess my answer, I think, would be no, because I don't think you would be acting under color of law in that aspect.
Well, then you don't understand what acting under color of law is. Well, suppose
the court issues an order.
The court issues an order. Usually in prior restraint cases, these orders are called injunctions, right? The court issues an injunction. The injunction says, if you ever dare criticize Judge Posner, the U.S. Marshals will come and cut out your tongue. Right? That's what it says.
Now I'm in agreement that would violate the First Amendment, Your Honor.
So how is this case different?
There is no...
Less dramatic. It's colorful.
Certainly. First, there was no prior restraint claim brought at the trial court level. This has always been a retaliation claim.
Well,
that's
actually...
just words, right?
I think that the word intimidation has always been there, and I will agree with you this far. You know, this is a case... that morphed, if you will, that took a different path as it needed to do after Garcetti was decided. The plaintiffs, at the time they filed the case, you know, were proceeding under what had been understood to be the law. The Supreme Court decides Garcetti. We all do that all the time. New cases apply to pending litigation. But as it happens, they had been complaining all along about intimidation. And I don't see any lack of notice at this point. They've tried to make clear that actions taken in the jail were designed to deter them and indeed designed to make sure that they did not show up and testify in this litigation that was filed after the Fields incident. So I don't think you can get around this by saying it wasn't in the case.
Your Honor, in, as we cite, in every retaliation case, the speech always...
But you're not thinking of it. This isn't a... There was a retaliation claim, which I was trying to discuss with Mr. Pierce, but there's also this other theory that they are now presenting. And even if we completely reject the retaliation claim, and I'm just speaking, you know, suppose if, you know, that kind of thing... Why can't you imagine? I could imagine intimidation by going out to the parking lot and slashing their tires and saying, you know, if you show up and testify at the Fields litigation. This is going to happen to you over and over again. And they've never opened their mouths. They've never said a word. There's just intimidation toward the future speech.
This court, and in fact, no court that we've been able to find in the country has recognized that kind of claim. And I think the
I think there are all sorts of claims about prior restraints on future public employee speech.
Sounds like a perfectly standard prior restraint claim. If a judge enters an injunction and the injunction says, if you dare, say, publish an article about nuclear bomb technology, you will be fined and imprisoned. Everybody understands that as a prior restraint claim. You don't have to have already published it in order to be able to litigate it. Why is it any different if the threat is made by an employee of the executive branch rather than an employee of the judicial branch? I assume the executive branch employees make standard executive branch threats. We'll fire you, or maybe in the Cook County jails, we'll push you down the stairs. Right? But what difference does it make which branch is making the threats?
In the other prior restraint cases, it's usually, as you said, either a judicial order or an administrative.
But historically, prior restraints referred to censorship, which was invariably executive.
Mm-hmm. But plaintiffs in this case have pointed to no rule or administrative
rule. How about a reason why this should not be actionable?
Your Honor, I think based on the ruling in Wernsing.
That's not a reason. A reason. Something's practical.
Because no one knows what the speech would have been prior to the speech actually occurring. I think that's why we have this line of cases that the speech has to happen first.
No, I don't understand you. Suppose a person says, suppose you say you're going to go out and you're going to take a megaphone on Dearborn Avenue and denounce the Seventh Circuit for its incompetence and rudeness. So we know exactly what you're going to say. If we say, well, you can't say that. You can say anything else, but you can't say that. What is the ambiguity that...
The plaintiffs in this case admitted there was...
No, I'm asking you about my case.
And your hypothetical is...
And in Judge Posner's hypothetical, you haven't uttered the words yet. It's just that you've been told you can't go out on the corner and criticize the Seventh Circuit for its rudeness and so on. But if you want to read Hamlet to the assembled throng, you're free to do so.
I don't believe that there was any evidence in this case that the plaintiffs were told that.
It wasn't a question about this case. There was a hypothetical question. We would really appreciate it if you would answer the questions the judges are asking rather than the question you wish they had asked.
Yes, Your Honor. If the court entered the order, I think that very well could be an issue. But as we've pointed out, there was no speech here. Plaintiffs admit that there was no knowledge by any of the defendants as to what they would do. In fact, one of the...
They say that's a contested fact, of course. They say that there's plenty of evidence to show that the defendants knew that they were aware of the facts surrounding the Fields incident and that they were prepared to go testify. And defendants were trying to cut them off at the pass. The defendants were trying to make sure they did not metaphorically go out onto the corner and criticize the jail.
During the hearing on the 26th, plaintiff's counsel admitted they had a causation problem they could not overcome.
That was in light of the district court's rulings on Garcetti. I think you're taking that comment out of context.
Your Honor, I don't think that there was any evidence introduced that the defendants had any knowledge as to what plaintiffs might say in the future, and I think that's what causes this problem. What someone might say in the future is not an actionable cause.
So are you saying there's no cause of action ever under the First Amendment for prior restraints? You know, if somebody were to issue an order saying that no one in the city of Chicago is permitted to go out onto the Daily Square and criticize President Obama, that we don't know exactly what they would say, but that's not covered by the First Amendment?
I am not saying that, Your Honor.
What's so strange about your argument is that a vague prior restraint is worse than a clear prior restraint, because then people have to, you know, to avoid punishment or whatever the sanction is, they have to steer far clear of what might be a speech that could appropriately be restricted. So I don't know, the fact that a person might not know exactly what he was forbidden to say would help you. Let me ask you a question about the Garcetti issue. Suppose you're right, these people could not complain about anything they did within anything they said to their superiors or to each other or what have you. But if they repeat the same thing to a newspaper or in testimony and so on, does that then become actionable?
I believe it could, Your Honor. I think Garcetti and the cases from this circuit interpreting it have found that where or how you make your speech could change whether or not it was protected speech.
Even if it was the same speech?
Even if it was. If I could turn to the protected speech issue. Based on Garcetti, anything that is said pursuant to plaintiff's official duties is not protected. The only protected speech they identified in this case was the testimony in the Fields litigation.
What about the language in Garcetti that very explicitly says just because something's written down as a policy isn't really either the beginning or the end of the inquiry, there's got to be a practical, factual examination of what the de facto policies were?
Yeah, I
the district court doesn't really do that. The district court kind of looks at the manual and says, okay, you know, this seems to be within the scope and there isn't any question. And indeed finds that reporting of abuse of inmates is within the scope of their official duties.
I would agree there has to be a practical inquiry. And in this case, both plaintiffs admitted that part of their duty was to report misconduct by other officers. And in fact, this court in the Hoskins case, considering what the duties were of correctional officers at the Cook County Department of Corrections, found that part of their duty was to report misconduct by other officers.
But at the same time, they're challenging that. I think they're trying to say that should be a duty. But the court says formal job descriptions often bear little resemblance to the duties an employee actually is expected to perform, et cetera. And it goes on in that vein.
Agreed, Your Honor, but I think based on plaintiff's admissions and this court's ruling in Hoskins that correctional officers at the Department of Corrections have a duty to report misconduct by others, I think it makes this speech fall within
their... Is it a matter of law? I mean, what if the factual record in a different case were different?
Your Honor, I do believe that the determination of what the duties are, it's a practical inquiry and it's to be done by the court as a matter of law.
But without any factual predicate, are we supposed to just do what the court said we shouldn't do, is just read the formal job description?
I think there can be some facts considered by the court, but I think as a practical inquiry, it would be hard to convince anyone that a correctional officer's duties didn't include preventing inmate abuse and reporting misconduct by other officers. In Callahan, I see my time is up. May I finish this point?
You always finish answering a judge's question.
In Callahan, the plaintiffs had admitted that as part of the Illinois State Police procedures, they had a duty to report misconduct. I believe we have the same admissions in this case, and therefore we would request that the district court's judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Pierce, anything further?
Very briefly, I think less than 5 minutes, depending, of course, on questions. The one point I do want to make is that with regard to the claim of prior restraint or intimidation, the speech in question, the testimony, it is agreed between the parties that that is speech which has First Amendment protection. And so with regard at least to that aspect of our claim, the difficult issues concerning what Garcetti means and how it is to be applied are not there. Secondly, under any construction of Garcetti, the question remains, what are the duties of the particular employee, and do those duties mandate the particular speech at issue? That factual inquiry, be it by the court or, it's a little unclear to me, but perhaps by a jury, was not done in this case. And for those reasons, the district court's ruling should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.